Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 45. It's July 1st, 2020. This book began accidentally while I was at work on another book about Wall Street and the 2008 U.S. financial disaster. I'd become interested in a tiny handful of investors who made their fortunes from the collapse of the subprime mortgage market. Back in 2004, the biggest Wall Street investment banks had created the instrument of their own destruction, the credit default swap on the subprime mortgage bond. The credit default swap enabled investors to bet against the price of any given bond, to short it. It was an insurance policy, but with a twist. The buyer didn't need to own the insured asset. No insurance company can legally sell you fire protection on another person's house, but the financial markets can and will sell you default insurance on another person's investments. Hundreds of investors had dabbled in the credit default swap market. A lot of people had thought, at least in passing, that the debt-fueled U.S. housing boom was unsustainable. But only 15 or so had gone all in and placed enormous bets that vast tracts of American finance would go up in flames. Most of these people ran hedge funds in London or New York. Most usually avoided journalists. But on this topic, at this moment, they were surprisingly open. All had experienced the strange and isolating sensation of being the sane man in an insane world. And when they talked about their experience, sounded as a person might if he had sat alone in silence in a small boat and watched the Titanic steam into the iceberg. A few of these people were temperamentally ill-suited to solitude and silence. Among this subset was the manager of a hedge fund called Hayman Capital in Dallas, Texas. His name was Kyle Bass. Bass was a native Texan in his late 30s who had spent the first years of his career, seven of them at Bear Stearns, selling bonds for Wall Street firms. In late 2006, he'd taken half of the $10 million he'd saved from his Wall Street career, raised another $500 million from other people, created his hedge fund, and made a massive wager against the subprime mortgage bond market. Then he'd flown to New York to warn his old friends that they were on the wrong side of a lot of stupid bets. The traders at Bear Stearns had no interest in what he had to say. "You worry about your risk management, I'll worry about ours," one of them had told him. By the end of 2008, when I went to Dallas to see Bass, the subprime market had collapsed, taking Bear Stearns with it. He was now rich, and even in investment circles, a little famous. But his mind had moved on from the subprime mortgage bond debacle. Having taken his profits, he had a new, all-consuming interest: governments. The United States government was just then busy taking on to its books the subprime loans made by Bear Stearns and other Wall Street banks. The Federal Reserve would wind up absorbing the risk, in one form or another, associated with nearly $2 trillion in dodgy securities. Its actions were of a piece with those of other governments in the rich, developed world. The bad loans made by highly paid financiers working in the private sector were being eaten by national treasuries and central banks everywhere. In Kyle Bass's opinion, the financial crisis wasn't over. It was simply being smothered by the full faith and credit of rich Western governments. I spent a day listening to him and his colleagues discuss, almost giddily, where this might lead. They were no longer talking about the collapse of a few bonds. They were talking about the collapse of entire countries. And they had a shiny new investment thesis. It ran roughly as follows. From 2002, there had been something like a false boom in much of the rich, developed world. What appeared to be economic growth was activity fueled by people borrowing money that probably couldn't afford to repay. By their rough count, worldwide debts, public and private, had more than doubled since 2002, from $84 trillion to $195 trillion. We've never seen this kind of accumulation of debt in world history, said Bass. Critically, the big banks that had extended much of this credit were no longer treated as private enterprises, but as extensions of their local governments, sure to be bailed out in a crisis. The public debt of rich countries already stood at what appeared to be dangerously high levels, and in response to the crisis, was rapidly growing. But the public debt of these countries was no longer the official public debt. As a practical matter, it included the debts inside each country's banking system, which, in another crisis, would be transferred to the government. The first thing we tried to figure out, said Bass, was how big these banking systems were, especially in relation to government revenues. We took about 4 months to gather the data. No one had it. The numbers added up to astonishing totals. Ireland, for instance, with its large and growing annual deficits, had amassed debts of more than 25 times its annual tax revenues. Spain and France had accumulated debts of more than 10 times their annual revenues. Historically, such levels of government indebtedness had led to government default. Here's the only way I think things can work out for these countries, Bass said. If they start running real budget surpluses, yeah, and that will happen right after monkeys fly out of your ass. Still, he wondered if perhaps he was missing something. I went looking for someone, anyone, who knew something about the history of sovereign defaults, he said. He found the leading expert on the subject, a professor at Harvard named Kenneth Rogoff, who, as it happened, was preparing a book on the history of national financial collapse. This time is different. 8 centuries of financial folly, with fellow scholar Carmen Reinhart. We walked Rogoff through the numbers, said Bass, and he just looked at them, then sat back in his chair and said, I can hardly believe it is this bad. And I said, wait a minute. You're the world's foremost expert on sovereign balance sheets. You're the go-to guy for sovereign trouble. You taught at Princeton with Ben Bernanke. You introduced Larry Summers to his second wife. If you don't know this, who does? I thought, who's paying attention? Thus, his new investment thesis, the subprime mortgage crisis, was more symptom than cause. The deeper social and economic problems that gave rise to it remained. The moment that investors woke up to this reality, they would cease to think of big Western governments as essentially risk-free and demand higher rates of interest to lend to them. When the interest rates on their borrowing rose, those governments would plunge further into debt, leading to further rises in the interest rates they were charged to borrow. In a few especially alarming cases, Greece, Ireland, Japan, it wouldn't take much of a rise in interest rates for budgets to be consumed entirely by interest payments on debt. For example, said Bass, if Japan had to borrow at France's rates, the interest burden alone would bankrupt the government. The moment the financial markets realized this, investor sentiment would shift. The moment investor sentiment shifted, these governments would default. Once you lose confidence, you don't get it back. You just don't, he said. And then what? The financial crisis of 2008 was suspended only because investors believed that governments could borrow whatever they needed to rescue their banks. What happened when the governments themselves ceased to be credible? There was another, bigger financial crisis waiting to happen. The only question in Kyle Bass's mind was when. At the end of 2008, he thought Greece would probably be the first to go, perhaps triggering a collapse of the euro. He thought it might happen within 2 years, but he didn't have a lot of conviction about his timing. Let's say it takes 5 years and not 2, he said. Let's say it takes 7 years. Should I wait until I see the whites of their eyes before I position myself, or should I position myself now? The answer is now, because the moment people think it national default is a possibility, it's expensive. If you wait, you have to pay up for the risk. When we met, he had just bought his first credit default swaps on the countries he and his team of analysts viewed as the most likely to be unable to pay off their debts: Greece, Ireland, Italy, Switzerland, Portugal, and Spain. He made these bets directly with the few big Wall Street firms that he felt were least likely to be allowed to fail: Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and Morgan Stanley. But doubting their capacity to withstand a more serious crisis, he demanded that they post collateral on the trades every day. The prices he paid for default insurance, in retrospect, looks absurdly cheap. Greek government default insurance cost him 11 basis points, for instance. That is, to insure $1 million of Greek government bonds against default, Hayman Capital paid a premium of $1,100 a year. Bass guessed that when Greece defaulted, as it inevitably would, the country would be forced to pay down its debt by roughly 70%, which is to say that every $1,100 bet would return $700,000. There's a disbelief that a developed country can default because we've never seen it in our lifetime, said Bass. And it's not in anyone's interest to pay attention to this. Even our own investors, they look at us and say, yeah, you got subprime right, but you're always out there looking for these extremely rare events, and so you think they can happen more often than they do. But I didn't go looking for this position. I was trying to understand the way the world was working, and this came to me. Now that he understood the way the world was working, he continued, he couldn't see how any sane person could do anything but prepare for another bigger financial catastrophe. It may not be the end of the world, he said, but a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money. Our goal is not to be one of them. He was totally persuasive. He was also totally incredible. A guy sitting in office in Dallas, Texas, making sweeping claims about the future of countries he'd hardly set foot in. How on earth could he know how a bunch of people he'd never met might behave? As he laid out his ideas, I had an experience I'd often had while listening to people who seemed perfectly certain about uncertain events. One part of me was swept away by his argument and began to worry the world was about to collapse, and the other part suspected he might be nuts. That's great, I said, but I was already thinking about the flight I needed to catch. But even if you're right, what can any normal person do about it? He stared at me as if he'd just seen an interesting sight, the world's stupidest man. What do you tell your mother when she asks you where to put her money? I asked. Guns and gold, he said simply. Guns and gold, I said. So he was nuts. But not gold futures, he said, paying no attention to my thoughts. You need physical gold. He explained that when the next crisis struck, the gold futures market was likely to seize up, as there were more outstanding futures contracts than available gold. People who thought they owned gold would find they owned pieces of paper instead. He opened his desk drawer, hauled out a giant gold brick, and dropped it on the desk. We've bought a lot of this stuff. At this point, I was giggling nervously and glancing toward the door. The future is a lot harder to predict than people on Wall Street would have you believe. A man who has been as dramatically right about the future as Kyle Bass had been about the subprime mortgage market collapse might easily fool himself into thinking he had a talent for being dramatically right about all sorts of other complicated things. At any rate, I was too interested in trying to figure out what had just happened in America to worry much about what was going to happen in the rest of the world, which seemed, at the time, a trivial matter. And Bass had more or less lost interest in what had just happened in America because he thought what was about to happen all around the world was so much more important. I made my excuses and took my leave of Dallas and more or less dismissed him. When I wrote the book, I left Kyle Bass on the cutting room floor. Then the financial world began to change again, and very much as Kyle Bass had imagined it might. Entire countries started to go bust. What appeared at first to be a story chiefly about Wall Street became a story that involved every country that came into meaningful contact with Wall Street. I wrote the book about the U.S. subprime mortgage crisis and the people who had made a fortune from it, but began to travel to these other places just to see what was up. But I traveled with a nagging question. How did a hedge fund manager in Dallas ever think to imagine these strange events? 2.5 years later, in the summer of 2011, I returned to Dallas to ask Kyle Bass that question. Greek credit default swaps were up from 11 basis points to 2,300. Greece was just about to default on its national debt. Ireland and Portugal had required massive bailouts, and Spain and Italy had gone from being viewed as essentially riskless to nations on the brink of financial collapse. On top of it all, the Japanese Ministry of Finance was about to send a delegation to the United States to tour the big bond investment funds such as PIMCO and BlackRock to see if they could find someone, anyone, willing to buy $500 billion worth of 10-year Japanese government bonds. This is a scenario in which no one alive has ever invested before, Bass said. Our biggest positions now are Japan and France. If and when the dominoes fall, the worst by far is France. I just hope the U.S. doesn't collapse first. All my money is bet that it won't. That's my biggest fear, that I'm wrong about the chronology of events. But I'm concerned what the ultimate outcome is. He still owned stacks of gold and platinum bars that had roughly doubled in value, but he remained on the lookout for hard stores of wealth as a hedge against what he assumed was the coming debasement of fiat currency. Nickels, for instance. The value of the metal in a nickel is worth 6.8 cents, he said. Did you know that? I didn't. I just bought $1 million worth of them, he said. And then, perhaps sensing I could do the math, I couldn't do the math, 20 million nickels. You bought 20 million nickels? Uh-huh. How do you buy 20 million nickels? Actually, it's very difficult, he said, and then explained that he had to call his bank and talk them into ordering him 20 million nickels. The bank had finally done it, but the Federal Reserve had its own questions. The Fed apparently called my guy at the bank, he says. They asked him, why do you want all these nickels? So he called me and asked, why do you want all these nickels? And I said, I just like nickels. He pulled out a photograph of his nickels and handed it to me. There they were, piled up on giant wooden pallets in a Brinks vault in downtown Dallas. I'm telling you, in the next 2 years, they'll change the content of the nickel, he said. You really ought to call your bank and buy some now. I doubt Kyle Bass was ever the sort of person who enjoyed sitting around an office and staring at a computer screen. He enjoys the unsettled life. We hopped into his Hummer, decorated with bumper stickers, God bless our troops, especially our snipers, and customized to maximize the amount of fun its owner could have in it. For instance, he could press a button and James Bond style, coat the road behind him in giant tacks. He roared out into the Texas Hill Country where, with the fortune he'd made off the subprime crisis, Kyle Bass had purchased what amounted to a fort, a 40,000 square foot ranch house on thousands of acres in the middle of nowhere, with its own water supply and an arsenal of automatic weapons and sniper rifles and small explosives to equip a battalion. That night, we tore around his property in the back of his U.S. Army Jeep, firing the very latest issue U.S. Army sniper rifles equipped with infrared scopes at the beavers that he felt were a menace to his waterways. There are these explosives you can buy on the internet, he said, as we bounded over the yellow hills. It's a molecular reaction. FedEx will deliver hundreds of pounds of these things. The few beavers that survived that initial night rifle assault would wake up to watch their dams being more or less vaporized. It doesn't exactly sound like a fair fight, I said. Beavers are rodents, he said. Whatever else he was doing, he was clearly having fun. He'd spent 2.5 years watching the global financial system and the people who ran it confirm his dark view of them. It didn't get him down. It thrilled him to have gotten his mind around seemingly incomprehensible events. I'm not someone who is hell-bent on being negative his whole life, he said. I think this is something we need to go through. It's atonement. It's atonement for the sins of the past. Once again, a hedge fund manager had been more or less right, and the world had been more or less wrong. Now seemed as good a time as any to pose the question that had nagged me for more than 2 years. Here you are, I said, in so many words, an essentially provincial hedge fund manager in Dallas, Texas, whose entire adult life has been lived within a few miles of this place. You speak no foreign languages. You seldom travel abroad. You are deeply patriotic. Your biggest philanthropic cause is wounded veterans. You hardly know anyone who isn't American. How did it even occur to you to start spinning theories about the financial future of these distant countries? It was Iceland that got me going, you said. I've always been interested in Iceland. But why? Did you ever play Risk as a kid? He asked. I loved playing Risk. And I'd always put all of my armies on Iceland because you could attack anybody from there. The belief that he could attack anyone from Iceland had led Kyle Bass to learn whatever he could about Iceland and to pay special attention when something happened in Iceland. He found out, for instance, that Iceland was held up by geographers as an example of a country with a special talent for surviving against long environmental odds. We kept saying, these banks are out of business, but the government kept saving the banks, he said. And right in the midst of this, Iceland went broke. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. How after 1,000 years of getting things right and overcoming all these natural obstacles, did they get it so wrong? I had my answer. His interest had started with a board game. It was ending with another kind of board game. And Iceland was once again a good place to start. And that, my friends, is the introduction to Michael Lewis's Boomerang, obviously a follow-up to The Big Short. The copyright on Boomerang looks like 2011. And you heard some of the years there, the important years that he, The Big Short, he covered the housing collapse. The people that shorted, it's a great movie. If you haven't seen the movie, watch the movie. I don't think Michael Lewis really had any involvement in the movie other than getting paid for the rights to the story. But the movie came out fantastically. And as with all of his writing, it's just exceptional. And in particular, he is such a gift for taking arcane, complicated financial topics and explaining them in plain English in a way that anybody could understand. Michael Lewis is a hero and a great writer. And I just recommend all of his stuff. And deep dive him on YouTube sometime. I'll put in the show notes at regular.fm/45. One of my favorites. It's that Big Think series, and they ask him about Iceland, actually, when Iceland went bankrupt, and he just got this great, great response. And Kyle Bass is a fascinating figure. I very much appreciate how he is unconventional. He's operating from Dallas instead of Wall Street, and finding these arenas where the big players are simply wrong, and finding it by actually taking the time to look at the data himself and to think for himself and not to accept a surface level report, but really truly to dig deep down, to really gather the data, to imagine him assembling a team and spending 4 months on this investigation and analysis and building a proprietary, I suppose at that point, look that even heralded experts like Kenneth Rogoff were flabbergasted by, surprised, had never seen. It is very reminiscent of his stories of the different players in The Big Short who, for example, went to the trouble to actually look at the actual mortgages inside these mortgage bonds and not simply accepting what turned out to be largely rubber stamps from required by regulation and borderline useless ratings agencies who were completely in the tank for the entire exercise. Just really wonderful stuff. And two, just the color of things like buying 20 million nickels, keeping them on pallets in a vault under a building in downtown Dallas. Brilliant stuff. In addition to going down the YouTube rabbit hole on Michael Lewis, basically anytime somebody posts like a 40 to hour minute talk by Kyle Bass, it's just great stuff. Of course, he's not always right. He's making risky bets. But after he assembles his positions, gets everything in place, he's happy to often to talk about his positions, his trades, And in general, he's very happy to talk about trends and how he sees the world. And we don't yet know. We're still living in the aftermath of this last financial crisis. Seen a lot of interesting stuff lately. Dylan Radigan in particular, I think I've shared some of his stuff in a previous dispatch. I will post in the show notes. He sat down recently with Jimmy Dore. Jimmy Dore, stand-up comedian and now a political commentator, had been on the Young Turks for quite a while, or a while, and split with them, I think, to a degree over Jimmy Dore becoming fed up with the so-called corporate Democrats, the DNC, and what they did to Bernie in 2016 and a whole bunch of these kinds of issues. And Jimmy Dore is just livid pissed. Often it seems to me, as a casual observer, more or less ready for actual revolution. I, agree with his diagnosis and diverge with him on prognosis, sort of what to do about it a lot. Interestingly though, he's done some collaborations and conversations with Dylan Radigan, and Radigan came up through Bloomberg for a long time, then was on CNBC. He was on MSNBC show, had his Howard Beale mad as hell moment railing against the bailouts and where we were, Republicans and Democrats completely complicit, and the old adage of, privatizing the gains and socializing the losses, bailing these people out, not bankrupting, not wiping out their common stock and forcing their creditors to take cents on the dollar, but just forcing the taxpayer and the dollar to paper over all this mess. Well, one of the interesting things that Radigan has pointed out in talking with Dore lately is how Dodd-Frank, clearly the too big to fail, the big banks, they've gotten only bigger. They're not getting smaller. The Potters are winning. The George Baileys are losing. There were a bunch of stories during those bailouts, TARP and all that stuff, about all these regional banks, responsible banks, who still held on to their mortgages, hadn't securitized them, hadn't fraudulently over-levered the whole thing and created this disaster with unqualified people being pushed into too much housing, too many mortgages, with these balloon payments and a variable rate and all the messes that came with that, that the banks that actually behaved responsibly suffered after the fact, and the big ones that were ruinously irresponsible were bailed out. And Radigan points out that Dodd-Frank sold as a financial reform bill, but it actually has now enabled is the system can spin up a TARP-like bailout on demand. It's no longer a political event. Geithner, Paulson, all these people, they had to go to Congress and get approval for that kind of a bailout. Nothing, just spin one up whenever they feel like it. So this entire world of high finance, Wall Street, and such. If you've been listening, I'm a believer in markets. I'm a believer in capitalism. I am. I'm a proponent of free enterprise. What this stuff is very little in common with that. And it's alarming. One of the things I would say about it is just imagine what it is that you own. What do you think you own right now? Maybe it's your house. You have a mortgage. Maybe some retirement accounts. What do you own? What is it worth? And how do you know? What do you own? What is it worth? How do you know? These are important questions, and they're hard to answer these days because so much of it's opaque. So much of it's political, or at least influenced by politicians. So much of it seems sort of corporatized. It's a little different world if you're Jamie Dimon than if you are not, if you're not too big to fail. And so it can be, it can be very confusing and very distressing and very demoralizing. I yesterday read an article about Frederick Bastiat, a French economist or perhaps economic journalist. He wrote a number of great books. The one I know better is The Law. I was going to read to give you a tiny taste of that. I was going to read a few quotes from it, and I'll link to it again in the notes in this episode. But these are from The Law. One is, socialism, like the ancient ideas from which it springs, confuses the distinction between government and society. As a result of this, every time we object to a thing being done by government, the socialists conclude that we object to its being done at all. We disapprove of state education. Then the socialists say that we are opposed to any education. We object to a state religion. Then the socialists say that we want no religion at all. We object to state-enforced equality. Then they say we are against equality, and so on and so on. It is as if the socialists were to accuse us of not wanting persons to eat because we do not want the state to raise grain. And here's another. If the natural tendencies of mankind are so bad that it is not safe to permit people to be free, how is it that the tendencies of these organizers are always good? Do not the legislators and their appointed agents also belong to the human race? Or do they believe that they themselves are made of finer clay than the rest of mankind? Life, liberty, and property do not exist because men have made laws. On the contrary, it was the fact that life, liberty, and property existed beforehand that caused men to make laws in the first place. But how is this legal plunder to be identified? Quite simply, see if the law takes from some persons what belongs to them and gives to other persons to whom it does not belong. See if the law benefits one citizen at the expense of another by doing what the citizen himself cannot do without committing a crime. And last one. Now, legal plunder can be committed in an infinite number of ways. Thus, we have an infinite number of plans for organizing it: tariffs, protection, benefits, subsidies, encouragements, progressive taxation, public schools, guaranteed jobs, guaranteed profits, minimum wages, a right to relief, a right to the tools of labor, free credit, and so on and so on. So these ideas obviously do connect to Kyle Bass, his investigations, and watching what's actually happening, getting underneath the data, looking at what these governments are doing, and what's really, to Bass's credit and the people profiled in The Big Short, is they figured out a way to bet against this stuff, and they really put their money where their mouth is. He went out and put up $10 million of his own dollars, raised $500 million, and was making these exceptionally risky bets. And if you read The Big Short, you can see too just some of the toll psychologically and the stress and the battles that these people went through to get it done. Now, for all of us out here as citizens, it's very dizzying. There's a whole bunch of upheaval, unrest, division going on right now. A lot of focus on one party versus another. But the really sad thing for all of us is we're clearly just being played. We're being played. It's divide and conquer. It's a pretty easy game. And we, in my definite opinion, get too absorbed in the theater of it all. And the media is just this shrill, useless, incredibly information-empty chamber of horrors that's not telling us anything. And you go back to Gatto's 7 Lessons of a School Teacher. It's just sowing confusion, incoherence, and dependence. And that's no good. That's not where we need to be. That's not where we need to be. I realized today that in addition to yesterday being the birthday of Frederick Bastiat, who was, you know, in the first part of the 1800s, a living person, another wonderful, great thinker and economist. He turned 90 yesterday as well. They share a birthday, and that's Thomas Sowell. And so here I am encouraging you to kind of go on the web to the library, wherever you can, and dig into Frederick Bastiat, Michael Lewis, and Kyle Bass. But also, and maybe at the top of the list, is Thomas Sowell. Here's another figure who is a great exemplar on the simple notion that he gets interested in a question and then he goes and looks for himself and learns and follows where the information takes him. And the one thing I wanted to share this evening, rather than getting into any of his actual writing and scholarship, the guy's prolific. He's written tons of stuff, books and essays and all kinds of things. But he has this very nice idea, which is when you hear somebody with some kind of policy prescription from whichever political side of the aisle they're coming from whichever side of any given issue, when someone has a policy prescription, there's three questions. When they're making their claims, it's compared to what? That's one. Compared to what? Two, at what cost? And three, what hard evidence do you have? These are nice, critical thinking, analytical, honest, methodical, deliberate questions to begin the process of trying to find our way through, in Wendell Berry's terms, to a sentence that makes sense, that we can impart to another person such that they'll understand. Compared to what, at what cost, and what hard evidence do you have? I love that. And if you remember too, just a few minutes ago, I also put out the questions for all of us, like, what do you own? What is it worth? And how do you know? That's why, like, liquid big markets with transparent information that's honest is so vital, so that as we all make choices and trade with each other what we should do tomorrow, what assets we should go accumulate, what trades we should make in all facets of life, it's really important that all of that be on the up and up, so that we understand as best we can what we own, what it's worth, and we know how we know. Partly we know because there's all this wonderful trade in that particular asset. One of the things I want to start talking about too is, now that I've read a little bit of Michael Lewis talking about these financial crises, is a notion that at the time, and when the response from the government and central banks is simply to issue credit, to create money by issuing credit, by adding it to the balance sheet of the Fed, and all of these kinds of moves, they're treating things as if they're credit crises, that as if the crisis is there's a lack of credit in the economy. But one of the things I want to start, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not this week, but soon, layering into this, that again, as all of this, it all goes into, it's all these threads wind into this one rope. But I really think one of the things that we're living through is not a credit crisis at all. In fact, we're awash in too much credit. We're living through a credit worthiness crisis. We really are. And I hope to get into that very soon. Thanks, y'all.